Hello, my name is Tucker Johnson from NIMSY Insights, and today we are covering some breaking news that has the potential to reshape the language access policy, the language services industry, and the lives of millions of people across the United States. Just hours ago, multiple news outlets confirmed that President Donald Trump is set to sign an executive order declaring English the official language of the United States. This is a major development and one that raises far more questions than answers. What does this actually mean for language access in the U.S.? How will it impact limited English proficient communities who rely on services in healthcare, education, and the legal system? And what about the language services industry itself, an industry that generates billions of dollars and employs thousands of translators, interpreters, and linguists across the country? To help us break this all down, I'm honored to welcome Dr. Bill Rivers, widely recognized as the foremost expert on language access policy in the United States. Dr. Rivers is a longtime advocate for multilingualism, former executive director of the Joint National Committee for Languages, and a tireless lobbyist working on behalf of language professionals and the communities they serve. Bill, welcome to the show. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks, Tucker. That's a very generous introduction. I think my mustache is widely recognized, and the rest of me just with it. So we had breaking news about 9:30 Eastern time here on the East Coast. I'm just outside of Washington, D.C. in suburban Maryland. And to the effect that there'd be an executive order coming out that, number one, declared English the official language. That's actually the less important part. Symbolic, doesn't really have an effect. Executive orders aren't actually the law. But I'll cover some of that as we get into it. The more important part of this executive order, at least according to the way it's been reported in the press, is that it would revoke Executive Order 13166, which was signed by President Bill Clinton in August of 2000. And that executive order required every federal agency to provide language access to its services if people needed language access, to create language access policies and plans, and then to further require that any recipients of federal funding, whether that was through a grant or contract, whether it was directly or as a subcontractor, also provide language access. That's grounded in Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which says no person in the United States may be discriminated against on the basis of, among other things, national origin. You know, the no Irish need apply, that's discrimination. The Chinese Exclusion Acts, those were discriminatory under the same theory. And that secondly, a Supreme Court case from 1974, Lau versus Nichols out of San Francisco, where a Cantonese speaking family sued the school district because her child was not being provided an equivalent education. The Supreme Court found unanimously that discrimination based on language status, that is, if you don't speak English, you speak another language, discrimination based on language status is tantamount to the same thing as discrimination based on national origin. That's 51 years ago. Lau v. Nichols, the Title VI of the Civil Rights Act is 61 years ago. Executive Order 13166 basically said, okay, we're going to clarify this for federal agencies and for their recipients of funding. And when you think about that, in the United States, you look at Medicare, Medicaid, that means almost every healthcare provider, pharmacist, doctor, physical therapist, whatever it is, hospital, clinic, HMO, if they are receiving payments from Medicare or Medicaid, and now from basically any healthcare, which is a separate law that I'm going to come to in a second, they are obligated to provide language access. They are obligated to not discriminate. And the same applies for school systems. Every school system in the country and a significant number of private and parochial schools and charter schools receive one or another form of federal funding, whether it's for Title I funding for low SES kids, low socio kids that are, lower on the socioeconomic scale, Title III funding, which is for multilingual learners to support their development of English proficiency, et cetera. And so, the State Highway Administration, they're getting federal funding to help maintain the highways. And so if they're going to build a new interchange or a freeway through your neighborhood, Tucker, they are obligated to hold a hearing. And if there are, you know, people in that neighborhood who don't speak English, they're obligated to provide language access. What this executive order, and we haven't seen the final text yet, so, you know, the devil's in the details. What this executive order does is said, okay, well, we're not requiring every federal agency to have a language access plan. That's what's been reported. We haven't seen reporting on the flow down requirements, as we call them in the federal contracting game, the flow down requirements with regard to language access for recipients of federal funding. But it is reasonable to assume that that will be left to the discretion of each agency. Now, there are a couple of big exceptions. This does not touch the Americans with Disabilities Act. And that is a law that, you know, when it says act, it means it's a law. Doesn't touch the Rehabilitation Act, which covers rehabilitative services for among other things, for children with physical disabilities in schools. And it also extends to kids who may be deaf, and they're covered under both the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act. And it covers LEP kids who might have what's called a 504 plan, Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. So if the family doesn't speak English and the child needs support, for example, for physical disability, then those meetings have to have language access. Doesn't touch, this executive order will not touch the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA, right? It won't touch the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, also known as the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Section 1557 of that law requires that all covered entities, which is basically now any entity providing health care, doctor's office, clinic, Medicare, Medicaid, VA, et cetera, a whole bunch of stuff, is also required to provide language access. That's federal law. So, you know, the executive order cannot be used as a magic wand to just wave away these things. But, you know, there's real concern that, you know, and it's reasonable to assume in the current political climate, and I'm not being political, I'm just making the observation, mm-hmm. that, okay, now federal agency ABC, and there actually may be a federal ABC agency.
There might be.
I don't know all the acronyms, even though I've lived here for 30 years in the DC area. That agency is now left to its own discretion as to whether they have language access policies and plans and guidance.
Yeah, because the federal, so this is a executive order that Trump set to sign, and really it's kind of overriding a previous executive order signed by Clinton, the executive order 13166, which clarified the provisions as outlined in Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, right? So we have, you know, executive order, law, going back to the law, and the executive order is just kind of clarifying the law and providing further direction around it, right? But a lot of these services are implemented and provided at the state level, state or even county or city level. Yep. And a lot of states, I don't know the numbers, but I can imagine not all states have language access policies or language access plans. Some of them do, some of them don't. So essentially what this is saying is it's not mandating government agencies to have a language access plan. Now, states like California, states like Maine, states like Washington here, and the smaller municipalities within those states are still free to have those language access plans and policies. They're just not mandated to, because previously there was a mandate that all states and local governments need to provide language access or risk losing federal funding. Wasn't that the feds, whoever was in office, could come in and make any state do something, but they could tie funds to it and say, if you're not doing this, then we're going to revoke the funding from
you. And that's how we got, you know, back in the day under the Nixon presidency, the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit.
Right.
That's
the classic case study for those learning about how the federal government interacts with the states.
If you want federal support for highways, interstate highways, state highways, you know, bridges, tunnels, whatever, you had to lower your speed limit to 55. Now, that wasn't done out of concern for safety. It was actually done for fuel economy.
Right.
And you think of the barges that people were driving in 1974, like my family had a It was a Chevy Bel Air, and I'm sure it got like 12 miles a gallon in neutral with a tailwind going downhill.
Right.
You know, okay. So that's, or you have to raise the drinking age to 21 in order to keep your federal highway funding. And that's how the federal government generally tends to not impose, but incentivize states to do what it wants. And so the way that civil rights works, you don't get paid extra for not discriminating. You're just not supposed to discriminate. Right. Title VI says no person, that means no one individual may be discriminated against based on any of these categories. There are two types of discrimination. There's disparate impact and disparate treatment. The obvious one is disparate treatment. No Irish need apply. Disparate treatment, you're singling out individuals based on a specific category. Disparate impact is when you say, okay, if you want to work for the Seattle sewer department, you have to be 5'10" and you have to be able to do 3 pull-ups or 5 pull-ups and, you know, whatever. And that, you know, that discrimination, that actually happened quite often in the early 70s with police and fire departments. And so who are you screening out? If you say you have to be 5'10", well, you're screening out a lot of women who are not going to be 5'10". Screen me out because I'm, you know, short and fat and ugly. That's fine. You're also screening, you know, like if you're putting on tests for upper body strength, right? So the case law developed, because there's no distinction originally in Title VI and to this day in Title VI in the law, there's no distinction between disparate impact and disparate treatment. So historically, language access, unless we say we are not going to accept patients from this country or who speak this specific language, that's disparate treatment. Mm-hmm. And if you have been discriminated against with that level of specificity, you have the right to file, you have the right to go to court. Disparate impact is like, we're not going to provide interpreters. And so that doesn't single out any particular group. Mm-hmm. And in that case, you don't have the right to go to court under a different Supreme Court case, Sandoval versus Alexander, which was decided in the early 2000s. But you do have the right to file a civil rights complaint. And that's basically the legal framework that has undergirded this. But what Executive Order 13166 did, it kind of turbocharged, especially in healthcare and to a lesser extent in education and other public services, turbocharged the language access part of the language industry, providing language access, and in particular, interpreting, because you only have to translate a document once into whatever language, and then it's available, and, you know, it gets revised or whatever, the new language is needed, you can translate it again. But it really turbocharged what we used to call community interpreting, which is now healthcare interpreting, got legal and judicial interpreting, got educational interpreting, we've got self-community interpreting. Really turbocharged those verticals. And, you know, we haven't seen the text of the executive order yet, so we can speculate as to what the effect may be, but it clearly does send a signal that not only that language access isn't a priority, that in fact this administration may be opposed to language access.
Yeah, I mean, and come on. Is anyone surprised, right?
Yeah, you're looking at the surprise on my face.
Exactly. So, like, when I read this headline, I was like, yeah, well, that sounds about right. And it wasn't.
Yeah, it checks.
Yeah,
checks.
Tracks just fine with what else has been going on. But my main question was, and this is why I'm grateful for you coming on today. I have this question because a bunch of people have been reaching out to us with this question, and I'm sure your phone's been ringing off the hook all day long. What does this mean for the language industry? What does it mean for interpreters, translators? What does it mean for limited English proficient people? And from what I'm hearing from you so far is it's an executive order, but at the base of these executive orders, they're really just ways to clarify and provide further direction on Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which still stands. And there's not much teeth. This isn't the Trump administration can't come in and say, you're not allowed to provide language access anymore. All it can say is, we don't really care if you provide language access anymore.
Yeah, and so first off, it's very important to remember executive orders do not have the force of law. They are binding on the executive branch. It's just, you know, it's a hierarchical organization. The president's at the top.
You need to send that memo to some of your friends over there in Washington. Yeah,
but it's not, it doesn't, you know, the legislative branch can do what it wants to do, the judicial branch. It's not binding on Tucker Johnson or Bill Rivers or NIMSY or any of the language companies in the United States. But it does have this potential effect. And, you know, this is why the details are going to really matter, of reducing federal attention to and support for language access. Hmm. You know, and you could imagine, you know, the Department of Housing and Urban Development deciding it's not going to have a language access plan. I'm just using them as an example. Mm-hmm. But then if language access isn't provided in, you know, say affordable housing situations, or for mortgage applicants for various federally backed mortgage programs, then it does raise this question. Well, okay, that could be very well be seen as discriminatory, could lead to civil rights complaints, could lead to suits. And so it's going to be incumbent on each agency to sort that out. It's reasonable to, you know, it is a reasonable conjecture to say there'll be a lot of pressure on cabinet agencies to drop their language access policies at the, you know, the department-wide level and what have you. And I'm not sure if there's going to be any recourse for that.
Right.
But the reality is we still have 71 million, at least, Americans who speak a language other than English at home. That's their primary language at home, is not English. 26 million of whom, at least, are limited English proficient. And any one of the other 71 minus 26 is 55. Any one of the other 55 million might need an interpreter. Mm-hmm. You know, I tell this story all the time. My father-in-law, who is born in Damascus, his parents were survivors of the Armenian genocide, grew up in Syria, and then it wasn't even called Syria then. And then his parents moved into the Soviet Union. Then he immigrated to the U.S. as an asylee and refugee in the 70s with his wife and two kids. Worked for 30 years in Los Angeles as an engineer. When he retired, his English was pretty good. That he retired 30 years ago. He's in his 90s. I'm the only person he ever speaks at any length to in English. And most of the time we end up speaking in Russian or French. He's 93, he needs an interpreter now when he goes to Kaiser. Yeah. He's not picked up as limited English proficient. And the point is, you know, I'm sorry to tell a long story. The point is that any number of, you know, it's possible any one of those other 55 million people who live and reside in the U.S., 80% of whom are either citizens or permanent residents or have other legal status here, they could need an interpreter at any point, you know. You know, filing for a building permit, that might be, you know, there's, you know, that's a real thing, and it's complex and it's detail oriented. It's a lot of bureaucratic language. You might need that translated. So in market terms, that market's still out there. The need for this service is still out there. And, you know, this is not, the president can't wave a magic wand and say, okay, well, we're not going to provide language access. And then you get to, okay.
Sure, but just to piggyback on that thought, he can't wave a magic wand and take away language access. But if he's taking away the requirements for profit, because hospital organizations are for profit, right? In theory.
Even when they're nonprofit.
When they're nonprofit, right?
You still. Like, people don't understand this. I ran a nonprofit for 8 years. You still have to make money, because if you lose money, you're no longer a nonprofit. You're bankrupt.
Exactly. So what's to stop a hospital or a group of hospitals from, you know, running some spreadsheet? You know, they do an audit, a financial audit, see where they can find some efficiency, and they realize, hey, we're losing money paying for all of these interpreters. Why don't we just, when someone who doesn't speak English come in, why don't we refer them to the hospital down the road and refuse service to them?
So you're putting it up, you're setting on a tee for me. Like, so, okay. First is that there's additional law in healthcare that requires language access. We've talked about that. The second is there's substantial evidence, substantial research has been done over the last 30 plus years, almost 35 years now, where the provision of language access in healthcare leads to improved patient outcomes, fewer readmissions, fewer malpractice claims, better patient adherence to instructions, you know, prescription instructions, discharge instructions, and so on. Patients live longer and better lives. Healthcare providers save money when they invest in language access. But our industry has, since the late 80s, sold this as a compliance issue. And you end up selling into a cost center.
Yeah.
Then you're in a fight with the CFO.
Oh yeah, no.
And you're going to lose that fight.
Nimsy's done some of that research. Like it's clear that if you're serving limited English proficient patients, then providing language access is in your best interest financially.
Yeah, there's an ROI on it. It more than pays for itself. But that's not widely understood. And it's still too often in the hands of compliance and risk managers, maybe the patient advocacy office, but it's not in, it's not seen as a profit center. And no one wants to sell into a cost center because that's the job of the CFO is to minimize the costs, sure. To boost the bottom line, boost the margin, you minimize costs, you increase revenues. That being said, there's a project underway at UMass, Brigham and Young and Harvard and in Boston that is a meta-analysis of all these studies. It's trying to show, kind of once and for all. I mean, there's no magic bullet. It won't be once and for all. But that in fact, we've got 35 years of research on this. The provision of language access in pretty much any service. If you think about there was an issue recently around a rule around mortgage servicers and loan originations. It's in the bank's best interest. It's in whatever agency is guaranteeing that loan's best interest, whether it's the VA or FHA, whatever it is. It's in their best interest that people who are signing the papers understand what they're signing.
Right.
Otherwise,
there's no deal.
Right. Like in Maryland, when you go close on a house, you get to read every word of every document. It takes like hours, right? You have to read every page and then initial. It's like, and then it's back and, we'll put an interpreter in there,
So what I'm hearing is taking out the requirement from the federal government for provision of language access for all of these different things, just taking that out, which Trump's kind of doing.
He's
doing it. So it's not a hypothetical. There are enough what I could call like free market motivators to make sure that language access is still happening. So from the perspective of the individual and the communities requiring language access, there's not a whole lot. It's not time to panic yet.
Right. It's not time to panic. There are market-based reasons. There are, you've got the market and the supply and demand curve, right, and the equilibrium and adjustments through whatever. You also have the regular, the things that sort of constrain the market, regulation in this case, among which is regulation is really key here. So they're taking out one piece of that. But yeah, the market is still there. Now you come down to the communities who need language and communications access. And it has been a perennial challenge to, and you and I have been through this in other projects where we've worked with states and municipalities where, you go into a meeting and the limited English proficient members of the community, and sometimes even the community-based organizations that are helping them, don't realize that they have a right to language access. Right. And
or
that's,
they're afraid to speak up because perhaps they're undocumented. So they won't advocate for themselves, even if they do know that they have a right to language access.
Yeah, but remember, the best estimates we have are between 70 and 80% of the LEP population in the U.S. are, in fact, here legally. Yep. Whatever status, refugee, asylee, temporary protected status, elderly relatives who are exempt from taking the English language proficiency test when they get naturalized, young children who have not yet been to school, whether they are the children themselves are immigrants or they're born here and therefore are natural born citizens. There's all sorts of
for now.
Yeah, well, that's been enjoined.
That's a different interview.
Yeah, that's a different interview. That's been enjoined. Including by a judge in Seattle. So the demand is still there. And there's a study that was done about 10 years ago by the National Health Law Program. I don't have it in front of me, so it might be 8, might be 12. Something like 5% of malpractice claims have been attributed to miscommunication that itself was due to a lack of language access. And that it runs to like a couple billion dollars a year worth of malpractice claims. And you say, okay, well, that in an industry that is several trillion dollars a year, the largest single sector of our economy, right, is healthcare. You say, oh, that's a fairly small amount. Well, it's not a small amount to the insurance companies. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not a small amount to their clients who now have increased premiums. And, you know, we've seen consistently that insurers want to see evidence of quality language access, the provision of quality language access. Hospital and healthcare accrediting organizations like the Joint Commission on Accreditation want to see that. The American Bar Association has issued guidance on language access in the legal setting, whether that's, you know, depositions in the lawyers, you know, in the law offices when you're just talking through the case all the way through to, you know, actual trial. That none of that changes, right? But this is still very, you know, we have to see the details. And I think there is the possibility that, you know, state and local agencies may feel they're no longer required to do this. Other recipients of federal funding feel that they've been left off the hook because the specific wording and specific requirements of Executive Order 13166 may no longer exist. You know, and sometimes there's a calculation that happens like, okay, well, we're just not going to do this because we can absorb the costs of an investigation, potential litigation that's going to be cheaper than actually providing this, actually doing this compliance. I have my opinions about that approach. Most of them are not suitable for a live stream.
Those are market-driven. That's the market-driven motivations we're talking about, right?
And when I see that, or when it's presented to me from, you know, like the covered entity side, the client side, it's like, well, yeah, you can go down that road, but do you really want to? Do you know? Because that's and if through some discovery that's found that through the adversarial legal process, it's uncovered that was your approach, then now your liability is very different. Yeah. And your risks are very different.
Exactly.
You know? Like deliberately violating the law is a different thing, right? You know, and getting caught doing it. I'm not saying that happens very often. You know, it happens here and there. And in reality, you've got multiple states. Migration Policy Institute curates a list. Like on the West Coast, California, Oregon, Washington all have state level language access requirements.
Right.
And smart healthcare administrators know that this is a, you know, this isn't, there's an ROI, this is a benefit. It's not just the right thing to do, it boosts the bottom line. You know, not just the right thing to do, it's not just that we get better patient outcomes, we also save and make more money doing it. None of that changes, right? None of that changes with this executive order.
Well, I'm hearing a lot of, like, all right, this isn't, calm down, people. This isn't the end of the world. Let's see what it says. You know, be skeptical, but let's keep learning more about it. We've talked about how this affects different government agencies. We've talked about how it's going to affect the people in need of these services. What about the language services providers out there, the translation companies, the interpretation companies? Because this is... There's, and I know a lot of, you know, friends with a lot of these companies that 70% of their revenues coming from language access work in one form or another, whether that's in healthcare or whether it's, which we've talked about, is still covered, or whether it's direct contracts with government agencies. So,
right. Well, so there are a lot of threads there.
How much should we be panicking? A lot or a real lot?
Well, it depends on your situation.
Sure.
And, you know, the best day to diversify if you haven't yet is right now, is today. Hmm. Just like the best, if you haven't planted a tree, the best day to plant the tree is today, right? And people who have exposure to federal contracts of any kind, whether language access or, you know, whatever it is, you know, they're at risk, because the obviously this administration has been slashing contracts left and right.
And that's where they have this administration has the most control, is
yeah.
the federal direct contracts. Or contracts with NGOs that are directly funded
right.
by the federal government.
Right. And so, okay, that's one piece. The second piece is for those companies that are out there providing language access in whatever sector, education, healthcare, and most of the bigger companies end up providing language access across multiple sectors. Mm-hmm. Healthcare is almost always the biggest one. You know, we have education, we have law enforcement, we have other types of public service, we have municipal government meetings, et cetera. And yeah, there is this potential for, you know, the chilling effect of immigration enforcement, although there have been no confirmed raids on schools or religious, you know, places of worship or
right.
healthcare providers. There are no confirmed reports of that.
Yeah, because people were kind of freaking out about that because Trump authorized the ICE to go into
yeah.
all of these places where historically they just didn't go. They had policies against it, but we haven't really seen that happen.
And then, yet. You know, and then there's the potential chilling effect where immigrants, whatever their status is, they might avoid going to the hospital or to their doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Hospitals and healthcare providers generally do not inquire about immigration status. They inquire about your insurance.
Yeah,
you know, you're gonna pay us
as long as they're getting paid.
Where you're from, yeah. You know, and so, and when I've talked to a number of CEOs over the last 2 weeks, we haven't had any solid indications that there's a chilling effect. Maybe our growth rates are slowing a bit, which for an industry that has enjoyed, you know, phenomenal growth rates ever since they have been tracked, you know, you know, if your company's growth rate slows down, that feels pretty bad. But we haven't had now this may come to pass, right? It may yet come to pass. And by the way, all predictions are guaranteed wrong or your money back. I stole that from Greg Easterbrook in his old Tuesday morning quarterback column, you know, from 10 years ago. I have to full disclosure in case anybody ever watches this.
That's why I don't make predictions. I just invite people on the show to make predictions for me.
So when you step back, how are we going to respond to this?
Mm-hmm.
There will be a coordinated effort by a fairly broad and diverse coalition of groups that are, you know, ethnic affinity groups, immigrant rights groups, health law groups, healthcare rights groups, the language industry, where, okay, once we see this executive order, we'll be able to respond to it. You know, we'll have all the kinds of white papers that we're issuing all the time about, you know, here's the value of providing language access. You know, they'll get re-upped and refreshed. You know, I can't predict as to whether there will be litigation and who would do that or what other kinds of action will be done on some kind of organized basis.
Well, in order to go to the courts, someone would have to have standing to take it to the courts, right?
Right.
Like, which means
right.
something would have had to happen. And if all that's happening is Trump is designating an official language.
Yeah, but you have to remember
it's a Gulf of America situation.
That's a red herring.
Right.
That's a red herring.
Okay.
The designation of an official language is a red herring. There are 30 states that have official language designations. Some of them, like New Mexico, has New Mexico has two official languages. Hawaii has two official languages. Mm. Alaska has English plus all of the extant Alaska Native languages. There are other states that are English only, but it's purely symbolic.
Right.
I mean, sometimes there's support within the state for, you know, the teaching and learning of other languages. You know, there's an Alaska Native Language Commission. That's not the acronym, but I don't remember the exact acronym, you know, and there's state level, you know, state government support for learning and teaching those languages in the school districts. Okay, that's great. But the English language bit is a distraction. You know, that's the, you know, look, a moose, right?
Yeah, okay.
I think I got that from Far Side, but
that's
you know, I'm
dating yourself.
I am so dating myself. You know, but the real thing is, again, coming back to this, giving agencies the latitude to, you know, revoke, annul, cancel, unpublish, I'm not quite sure what the word is, their guidance and their language access plans, that could have an effect. Especially, you know, like, I think healthcare is pretty well insulated right now. Again, I could be wrong. The judicial system, the federal judicial system, first off, it's a separate branch of government. Second, there's the Court Interpreter Act. State judicial systems, there are a lot of states that have laws in place that require language access in the legal system that this executive order isn't going to touch. So, okay, so where else are we going to see that? You know, is it going to be the Forest Service, like Forest Service rangers who have law enforcement obligations in national forests? Are they no longer going to have a contract with you know, an OPI vendor to provide language access when they pull somebody over for speeding in a forest or lighting a fire or, you know, getting too rowdy at a campsite or whatever it is? You know, that's kind of the open question, and we don't know that yet.
Yeah, and I guess what it comes down to, I mean, I think if we keep talking much longer, we're just going to start going in circles here, because we don't have the language of the order yet.
Yeah, we really do need that.
Because, like, the question is, will it be challenged in court? Yeah, probably, because everything's getting challenged in court now. But it's like, how? What aspects of it?
Right?
And we don't know that until we see the actual language of the executive order.
Right. And you know, the moment we get it, it'll be shared.
Stay tuned for more.
Yeah, stay tuned for more. It's like
multilingual news at multilingual.com or NIMSY Insights.
No,
or
you guys do a great job covering this stuff. And, you know, I appreciate the opportunity to ramble on and on.
Yeah, well, you know, I appreciate you coming on today, Bill. Like I said, I'm sure your phone's ringing off the hook once this got reported on this morning. And I'm sure it will keep ringing off the hook for the weeks and months to come with all of the fun stuff with this administration.
Well, I will say the Association of Language Companies will be responding, as will a number of other organizations. You know, we work closely together with, you know, American Translators Association, Certification Commission on Healthcare Interpreting, National Association of Judicial Interpreters and Translators, the American Association of Interpreters and Translators in Education, the Registry of Interpreters for the Deaf, ALC, and I may be leaving off a couple of other organizations, for which I, you know, I apologize for that, in responding to this as an industry and a profession, you know, once we get the actual executive order. And then there will be a broader coalition. I'm not quite sure what shape it will take, that works on things like PR, you know, fact sheets, why you should provide language access. So I think the industry pretty good on those. Potential litigation if we find something that is, you know, a subject to litigation. But the whole point is, again, we're trying to protect protecting this protects, you know, it serves the interests of the industry and the companies. It serves the interests of the interpreters and translators of the workforce, and it serves the interests of limited English proficient individuals in the United States. And again, 80% of whom, best estimates that are out there, 80% of whom are here legally.
Right. And that's a message I feel with our audience here, anyone that's going to be watching this or listening to this, you're preaching to the choir on that. But that's a message out there. It's like a lot of Americans equate, oh, you don't speak English, you must be here illegally, you must be undocumented. And it's not, it's not the case.
Yeah, it's not the case.
All right. Well, I think this is a good place to wrap it up. Bill, we'll be talking more in the future. All of that stuff that you just mentioned you're doing, make sure to reach out so we can happy to help amplify that message when it's Thanks. Ready. And thank you so much for providing your insights to the audience today.
A pleasure as always.
All right, I'll take us out here. That brings Thanks. Us to the end of today's conversation, but it's far from over. We'll continue to cover this story at Multilingual News over at multilingual.com as well as at NIMZI Insights. That's NIMDZI.com where you can find that. Huge thank you to Dr. Bill Rivers for sharing his experience. And if you want to stay informed, make sure you're following Bill on social media for ongoing updates. Thanks to everyone that turned in. And stay with us as we track what happens next. Cheers.